This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
We're not used to doing
in-person
episodes.
I remember I have to be really close to this thing, right?
Yeah, I sit like that.
Like this?
Yeah. Are you recording? Oh, shit.
Always.
Hey everybody, this is Gordon in Boston. Mark is actually on vacation in Southern California right now, so I wanted to mix it up this week. And so standing in for Mark, we have Pat Brisbane, who's a Ruby developer here in Boston. He also is one of the guys kind of leading the push for Haskell and functional programming here in Boston. How's it going, Pat?
It's going pretty good, Gordon.
Do you want to give a quick background? How'd you get into Haskell?
Yeah, sure. It was a pretty interesting road. Started with the window manager Xmonad, which is a window manager for Linux. It's popular with Arch Linux, which is the distro that I use. And I had gotten into that sort of before I was into any kind of programming. They say that it's not really a window manager, but a library for writing a window manager. And then they just ship you a default implementation that you can go and edit as your version of configuration.
Cool.
And that was all in Haskell, so kind of just tweaking my window manager, I started to pick up Haskell a little bit. Got super interested in it, read everything I could, kind of grew from there.
Cool. So I wanted to talk about, and we can jump around if we need to, but I wanted to, like, I've been with Swift, and even just before Swift, I've been talking a lot on the show about trying to get into functional programming and the benefits that I see about functional programming. And I mean, I've been interested in Haskell for a little while now and kind of been fumbling around with it, but I've been really, really interested in terms of like how we can take those concepts and apply them to Swift to change, you know, the way we write apps. Like, you know, better or worse, I think that's arguable, but I think it's a more interesting way to write apps using type systems and functional stuff, functional concepts. So I just wanted to talk about, first, maybe we can get into some other stuff later. I wanted to talk about like how to get into this stuff. Cause I think a lot of people, I mean, you start seeing words, like you start looking at in Haskell and you start seeing all the operators and infix functions
right.
And in Swift they would be operators, but it's the same concept. But, you know, symbols as function names and words like applicative, functor, and monad, and monoid, and fmat, you know what I mean?
Like all those fun functional words that are super scary.
And because it's all, like, based in math, right?
Yeah.
It's all, like, it's lambda calculus, right? That's where all those words come from?
Or category theory, a lot of it.
Right, exactly.
Which,
even that's, like... Okay, cool. Category. Like, I don't know what the hell that means.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, all I can say is, like, you don't have to learn lambda calculus or category theory to use that stuff effectively.
Right.
It's good, I think, to use correct terminology. Like, there's value there.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want to use different words or, quote unquote, dumb things down to make it easier to understand. You definitely need to use the right words. But you can get into Haskell or any functional language and learn all that stuff really slowly. And it's not nearly as complicated as you think it is, for sure.
One of the things that's been hard and also helping is trying to learn to rely on the type system.
Yeah.
We've had conversations, like, recently about kind of, like, me trying to wrap my head around specific types in Haskell. And I don't know. I think that... So we've had, you know, a quote-unquote type system in Objective-C for years, you know what I mean? But it's fairly weak, and because it's all built on top of C,
a big difference, in my opinion, between a type system and a good type system.
Huge, yeah.
And I don't know, I feel like Haskell is sort of the first language that I've used. It's the first sort of on the bar of learning languages that actually has a good type system. Like, you could argue that something like AGD or Idris is better with dependent types. But if you're starting sort of at practical languages and popular languages, I think Haskell is the first point at which you hit something really powerful and really expressive. And it just changes the way you do everything.
Yeah.
You know, that whole trend that's going around that I totally agree with about how people think that Haskell's only for smart people.
Right.
And a lot of people that write Haskell write it because it's only for dumb people.
Right.
And it watches your back. It prevents you from making dumb mistakes.
Right.
And the whole thing is like, for me, a lot of it is type Legos. It's just, you know, I have something that I need. I've got these pieces that have these types. Like, how can I fit them together?
Right.
And sometimes there's only one correct way to fit them together, and the program writes itself at that point.
Right. Because then the compiler, like you're saying, like the compiler is checking your work. The compiler is not letting you, it's not letting you make mistakes.
Right.
Right. Because it just won't even get to that point.
Right. So, and a lot of time it feels slow. You know, it feels like, oh my God, I'm sitting here like struggling with these type errors forever.
Right. Right.
But like every 10 minutes you spend fixing a type error is a half an hour of runtime debugging that you're not going to have to do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth it, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's actually kind of a big change from Objective-C to Swift has been that the compiler has gotten stricter, obviously, because it's a stricter language. But then there are just so many things that have been warnings in Xcode and in the compiler. There have been warnings forever for a lot of these things. And we've always been a big proponent of turning on as many warnings as is reasonable. Like, there's some that are just not worth turning on because they just warn you about, like, language features. There was one where we had these auto-synthesizing properties, right? So so you create a property, and then what you used to do is you used to write on the implementation you do at synthesize and then the property name, and that would write the getters and setters for you automatically.
Yep.
And then they were like, well, that's stupid. If you're defining a property, you're probably, that was just a common pattern. You're going to want that. So they got rid of, they did auto-synthesizing properties. And I don't remember what warning it is, but there's a warning you can turn on. And when you do, then you get warnings for every time auto-synthesis is automatically synthesizing properties for you. And it's like, yeah, like that's
kind of what I wanted.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's warnings that don't make sense to turn on, but they've always been warnings. And one of the things that I think a lot of developers have gotten used to is being like, yeah. You know, like, I know what I'm doing, you know.
Yeah.
And the number of times I open a project and like from inherited code or legacy code or whatever, and you just end up with hundreds of warnings in the code. And so people got used to that, to writing that way. Like, yeah, warnings don't mean anything, you know, and they let them go. All of a sudden with Swift, those warnings 9 times out of 10 become errors. I very rarely see warnings. It's only errors because it's like, no, look, you're not conforming to this type signature the way you say you're going to. I wonder if that's causing problems for people.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard. It's a hard shift to make to putting in the effort up front.
Yeah.
I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, your program has types. Like, your program has interfaces. There's valid ways to use a value or not. That's just there.
Yep.
And if your language doesn't have a type system, then you're doing all of that work in your head anyway.
Right.
So wouldn't it be nice if something else could think about
right,
that?
Right, right, right. It's just offloading that mental capacity, you know what I mean, into the computer.
Yeah. And you have to be able to do it in a way that doesn't limit you. So you need an expressive type system. You need a good type system, something that'll still let you do what you want and have the same sort of, you know, abstractions that you need.
Polymorphism.
Exactly. Yeah. All of that stuff is necessary to be, for it to be good.
So what would you say to somebody, given that you've been doing Haskell for a while, you may have a weirder point of view on this because it was your first language. I don't know. Is that a common thing? Are there a lot of people that Haskell is their first language?
Every time I tell someone that, they're very surprised.
Right.
I mean, I work with mostly Rubyists, but in general, I think it's odd.
I get that sense. I get the sense that most, and the weird thing is you came into programming the same way I think a lot of people do, which is I have a problem and I need to solve it. Yeah. What language can I use to solve it? And people end up with whatever language. That's how I think a lot of people get into Ruby at the beginning or get into Python and stuff like that. Most people don't immediately reach for Haskell, but given that you were in this Haskell environment and the problems that you needed to solve were written in Haskell, kind of forced your hand.
Yeah. And it's addicting. Like, Haskell, I think, is totally addicting.
Yeah.
Like, once you start to look up a little bit of it and learn a little bit of it, like, there's so much depth there.
Yeah, yeah.
You can never get bored.
So outside of Haskell, because I don't know, people may or may not want to learn Haskell. I think it's worth learning because it has similar concepts to Swift.
Yeah.
I've heard Rust being compared more to Swift than Haskell.
Yeah. Honestly. I don't know. I've actually never even seen any Rust.
Yeah.
But I've heard that it has a good type system.
Yeah. I've heard that it's very similar to Swift. But what do you think someone's first steps would be for trying to get into this stuff, trying to learn?
Yeah. It's hard. It's if you want, like, are you trying to get into functional programming or are you trying to get into Haskell?
I think more than anything, I think at a high level, the functional concepts that Haskell presents in a very, very pure way, obviously. The functional concepts that Haskell presents are beneficial outside of Haskell and outside of Swift and outside of anything. Like, you can take these concepts and you can apply them to a certain extent to Ruby, and you can apply them to JavaScript. Mm-hmm. You can apply them to anywhere because you're learning about an idiom, not a syntax.
Yeah. I mean, I've met a lot of people that are sort of functional programming geeks, and they usually fall either in the Haskell category or the Lisp category.
Right.
I prefer Haskell because of the type system. Like, Lisp is totally untyped. Everything is just a list of tokens. Like, that's the whole language. And people like that because it's so flexible. But the thing I like about Haskell is more the type system than functional programming.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like with Swift, you know, it grew out of F#, which is also sort of related to Haskell. And there's a lot of the same ideas there, both functional programming and the type system.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to learn about these concepts, I would probably err on the Haskell side.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same recommendation is to learn you a Haskell book.
Yep.
I mean, it's on the shorter side. It's super entertaining. Talks about things at a high level. Starts slow. You know, if you want to get into that, I would just read that book.
I've said this a couple times to you off the air, but there's a functional programming in Swift book out from the Objective-C.io guys.
Yeah.
And Chris Eidhoff, who's the head of that, he's an old Haskell dev that moved over to Objective-C at some point. And so it's been really kind of funny watching him be like, oh shit, I can do all these things again. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I definitely agree that, you know, obviously we've had a bunch of these conversations before, but I've heard you say that like Swift needs to find their own way. Like, it's not, like, you shouldn't be trying to write Swift code to look like Haskell.
Right.
Just like you shouldn't be trying to write Swift code to look like Objective-C.
Right, right.
And I totally believe that.
Right. More than anything, it's just that I don't think that we should necessarily follow Haskell's guidelines just to follow Haskell's guidelines. You know what I mean? Like, it is a different language. It isn't a pure functional language. It's this mix of imperative and functional, and we can use that. But there have been times when it's like these two things, because we don't have some of the more like mathematically driven types. We don't have functors, or we don't have applicative. We don't have monads. Yeah. Not really. You know what I mean? Not like as a type.
Right.
One of the things I think people need to get, and I'm not sure if I've said this on the show, but those words, monoid and monad and applicative and functor, like, those are just type classes, right? So those in Objective-C, like, we've had that for
protocols.
Years. Protocols. Yeah. Protocols and protocols in Swift, those are type classes. It's just an abstract interface to something. So I think people see those terms and they're scary terms. And especially coming from an OO world, they're not really named very well. You know what I mean? I mean, from like an OO sense. Like, monad doesn't tell me what that does.
Unless you know what that word means.
Unless you know what that word means. And few, I don't know. I feel like very few people do, but... Or, you know, or people that are smarter than me, anyway. But so since we're missing some of those high level types, I don't know that we have to be as rigid about those types. You know what I mean? Like, for example, we couldn't have a return function.
Right.
Anyway, but like, one of the things that I kind of like that Swift does that I get is kind of weird is the implicit wrapping of optional values by just returning the value that's going to be contained.
Yeah, that weirds me out.
It's bizarre, and it takes a little bit of getting used to, but really what it means is you have to deal with values, and you have to deal with none.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I guess unless you're pattern matching, because then you have to match on some or none, and that's a little weird.
Yeah.
But that's like, and that is, I guess it's a little weird that that's the only time it pops up, because most of the time you have wrappers around that stuff. So, you know, we have that optional chaining, the question mark dot stuff. So you can just chain optionals together. And at any point in the line, if they fail, the whole thing fails. It's like,
it's like bind.
It's like bind.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like bind for members, not bind for passing functions. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
So the question mark dot works.
Right.
Works
so this is where, like, when the language mixes object oriented and functional, things get weird.
It gets weird.
And I always have issues with that.
That's it's like it's bind, but using, you know, get using, foo, get bar, yeah. get baz functions.
Right.
And passing those through.
Right.
You know what
it's
mean?
Like if I was trying to do this the other day when I was trying to translate monads to Ruby. It's like the bind function is it's as if the bind function is on an object. So this reference or self reference is the first argument.
Yeah.
Like that's the M of A.
Yeah.
And then that's how it behaves.
Yeah. I think there are some nice things in, I don't know. You can write Haskell. Not really. You can't write Haskell in Swift.
I don't know. Tony's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, but he ran into compiler issues at a certain point. You know,
is that because of the language or because it's beta?
It's not technically beta.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? It's been released. It's actually at 1.1 now. So
interesting.
So I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Honestly, is what it gets down to. I'm not sure what the problem is there. Yeah. I do know that he's pushing that stuff to its limits mm-hmm. because, you know, those aren't built-in functions.
Right.
And so he's using this functional stuff in a way that kind of pushes, like that amount of type inference
right.
is kind of wacky, especially for like a non-lazy
right.
language.
Yeah, the non-laziness is tough.
Yeah.
I see people try to translate this stuff to Ruby
mm-hmm.
a couple times at mm-hmm. least. I mean, Mike Burns has a gem. Joe's always thinking about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
for maybe, yeah, specifically?
For maybe and by extension, monads mm-hmm. or functors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you always find something where it just doesn't play nice.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, the type system, purity, or laziness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need all of them for these things to work as well as they do.
Yeah.
And I feel like in Swift, you know, it's the closest I've seen. Like
yeah.
Tony's applicative stuff for JSON parsing
yeah.
really looks like it
yeah.
and works like it and has
yeah.
a lot of the same benefits. It's the closest I've seen in non-Haskell.
Yeah.
And still, you know, you're saying he's running up against issues because of non-laziness, right?
Yeah, he ran into some kind of exponential compile yeah. time thing just because of the type inference. You
right.
know what I mean? You start with like maybe one or two or three properties being parsed out of JSON, then it was fine. You start to get into 5,
right.
10, 15, 20. Like, you know, that can happen. You know
right.
I mean? You can have objects with just tons and tons and tons of data attached to it. And it ends up being exponentially longer to compile, 10, 20, 30 minutes to
yeah.
compile these things. And then you can't.
And that really sucks because now what can you do?
Right. He was playing around with some of the type stuff and actually changed a lot of the syntax in this branch so that it doesn't look like Haskell anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It actually almost looks like a DSL,
hmm.
which is what it is. You know what I mean? And
right.
so my initial reaction to that was kind of like, well, that sucks.
Yeah.
It was nice to write Haskell-y stuff. But then at the same time, it's that same thing of like,
right.
why?
Yeah, it doesn't have to look like it. I
right.
mean, that would just be, you know, superficial.
Right.
But, you know, I liked that it used the same theory
right.
and that it worked the same.
Right.
That was really cool.
I think now what he's doing is he's creating a function. His parsing method builds a function. It
okay.
like returns a function and then you pass that function in.
Mm-hmm.
The framework would you pass an object into that function, I think, is the way it works. But
yeah.
similar. But
I mean, that's kind of how the Haskell side works, too. You have to define an instance of from.json
mm-hmm.
for your data type. And what you're defining is a parse.json function,
mm-hmm.
which is a function from
right.
JSON to your value. You know, so and then that ends up being used by the framework.
Yeah, the only difference there is that like he's actually returning a closure.
Mm-hmm.
And in Haskell, that's kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's really no,
yeah,
like it's just not specified to that
right.
level. Like it's just like
yeah.
functions or values. This is a function,
right?
Yeah,
I think we've talked a lot about maybe and optionals,
right?
And I've said before that I think it's an interesting way to kind of
to deal
in.
With null or to learn
yeah. that too. I love. I mean, I don't think I've ever said anything other than like that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like I hate. I didn't realize I hated nil until I got optional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, yeah, no, I want to codify that in my types.
Right.
I want to say, like, in Objective-C, since anything could be nil at any given point in time,
right.
you constantly had to either program in a way that was implicitly nil safe,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of times was okay because nil is a no op, and
right.
it's not like Ruby. Like, Ruby, nil gets in your system in Ruby, and you're just kind of screwed, right?
Yep.
In Objective-C, there were only a handful of places where it would blow up. It'd blow
right.
up if it started, tried to get dumped into a collection, it'd blow up if it, you know, nil was supposed to be a view controller and you tried presenting nil. Like, it has no idea how to do that. Right. You know what I mean? But stuff like the other big runtime error was, I have a method that takes a block. Is that block there or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And you always end up, and it's, you always, so you always, I always end up doing the same pattern in Objective-C, which is like, if completion block, completion block.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, that sucks.
It's annoying.
It's stupid to write. Every time I write it, I feel like an idiot. And like, that's fine if that block should be optional. But, you know, right. when we're talking about like a network callback, fetch a user, it's like, why would I not, like, you know what I mean? It's like, am I calling that for some weird side effect? That's probably not a good idea. Like, I'm probably doing something else wrong here. Why would you not ever not want the user back if I said fetch the user? So by, you know, once we get into Swift, all of a sudden I can codify that.
Now you've got a type safe, that function that types require you to have that.
And I know it's there.
Right.
And then even if it's not there, now I can use these functional concepts to abstract away that nil check.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm willing to bet that optionals are going to be the big window for a lot of people into functional stuff. You know what I mean? Because it is all of those things we've been saying. It is applicative. If it is a monad. It is a monoid. It is a functor. It's all of those things. And so because of that, you can do some interesting stuff with it. You can use fmap and bind and apply.
Yep.
And you can use these functional concepts that don't exist in Objective-C.
Yeah, it's very easy to show that it's the best of both worlds, because now you have this concrete type that tells you explicitly this value may or may not be here. But like you were saying, in Objective-C, you know, it was convenient to just chain them, right? Like just chain these calls together, because nil's a no-op, no big deal. And it only blows up when it gets to a boundary.
Right.
UI boundary, database boundary, whatever it is. You can totally do that using fmap on maybe.
Right.
Because you just fmap all your normal functions.
Right. So in Swift, we have this if let.
Mm-hmm.
I think they call it like optional unwrapping or conditional unwrapping,
right.
I guess. So you do like if let foo equals bar, assuming that bar is an optional something. And if bar is some thing, foo gets unwrapped, and that's a constant.
Mm-hmm.
So it's immutable, and it only exists inside the
yep.
positive branch. And that's cool. Like, I think it's really neat thing to be added into the language, especially coming in an imperative place where conditionals are what we're used to. You know what I mean? That's just how you deal with things. You just don't do pattern matching. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, when do you do pattern matching in imperative languages? Not super often.
Yeah, I mean, feel like. Unless you want to consider some kind of a switch statement, that sort of thing, but it's still different.
Right. And for us, coming from Objective-C, switch statements have only ever been integers.
Mm-hmm.
You can only do them with integers. Right. So they were just not super useful.
Right.
Now that we have like real switch statements, quote unquote.
Right. You know what I mean? Like, pattern matching only makes sense if you have values with multiple constructors.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't exist in a lot of languages.
Right. Slightly different terminology, I think, on
you guys have enums.
Enums, yeah. So they're enumeration values, not. But I mean, you can think of them as a constructor.
Yeah.
It's almost the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a weird semantic difference.
You can use them the same. They sort of have the same behaviors. It's just a different implementation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the if-let stuff is nice, but it just gets gross fast, right?
Because
once you end up with one or two or more nested if-lets, it's just like if-let, 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 and you're creating these constants and then using them all at the end, and then you have like this.
And those are that's the exact kind of staircasing that you clean up with applicative and monad in Haskell.
Right. No, exactly. Yeah. I think it ends up being far more readable. Like, I can look at that, and getting back to what you were saying at the beginning, it's like, if you just kind of like let that syntax wash over you, it's not super complicated. You know, even if it's all angle brackets and punctuation.
Yeah.
You know,
the super punctuation always puts people off.
Yeah. My argument has always been that, because people bitch about that constantly.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's just unfamiliarity.
Exactly.
I mean, look at a math expression of like
just
a normal mathematic equation of pluses and multiplication. You know, that's a super punctuation too, but you just know it.
Right.
And it would really suck if you had to write the word add and multiply everywhere instead
and,
of like
and
pluses.
put it all at the beginning.
Yeah, with a bunch
add
of parentheses.
Two, three.
Yeah.
Yeah. That wouldn't make sense.
No.
Yeah, people always come up with this complaint of like, oh, it's just not readable. It's like, no, it's...
It's actually really readable.
It's very readable. It's a familiarity thing, not a readability thing. It's that you don't know what those functions are, and that's fine. Like, that's a valid argument.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That there is a part of me that doesn't understand complaining about having to learn a new thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I feel like there's momentum for functional stuff right now. I don't know why.
Yeah,
I feel
I don't,
like there's functional
I,
stuff.
Functional I want to say that, but I also know that I live in a bubble.
Yes.
Like, I follow mostly Haskell people on Twitter. You know, I'm pushing Haskell at ThoughtBot. We've got, like, 8 people interested in it here. So, like, maybe that's why it feels like there's momentum now.
Yeah, like, yes, but I think Swift is an indication that there is momentum towards functional stuff. This is Apple. You know what I mean? Like, they're not really known for doing heavy-duty experimentation with their dev suite, whatever. You know, like, they've been criticized for the past 8 or 9 years about Objective-C and saying, like, you guys are waiting too long, you're going to get left behind, blah, blah, blah. Like, John Siracusa, I don't know if you know who John Siracusa is, he writes those massive... You may not know these either because you're a Linux guy, but he writes these massive, insane reviews on OS X. Super, super detailed. Just like everything you need to know about an OS X release. They publish them through Ars Technica as ebooks and stuff. Like, they're just massive, massive tomes of like anything you could ever possibly need to know about an OS X release. What's changed, what's different, all this kind of stuff. And they're fascinating reads. But he wrote this series called Copeland 2010 years and years and years ago. It was before 2010. I think it was before 2010. Where he was talking about how because Apple was holding on to Objective-C, that in a few years they were going to hit this wall. And what was going to happen was all of a sudden they were going to be left behind. And it was going to be very hard for them to catch up. Because look at what Microsoft had to do, you know what I mean, to get all their stuff over to C#. Or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, when they when they changed languages, it was a big freaking deal. When OS X came out and you had people moving to Objective-C the first time, it's just a huge, disruptive, problematic thing to do, to change the languages in such a massive, at a massive scale like that. So he was talking about how this was going to be a problem, and one of the things he said is like, and then I think he did a revisited thing a little bit later or whatever, but basically what happened is that they had this problem, and then the iPhone came out, and they kind of got their life extended because all of a sudden they had this low-level language that ran really, really well on these low-powered devices. You know what I mean? You're working in basically C, so it's all going to be very fast and easy to do. And they had mature frameworks around it and stuff. You know, so they've been criticized about being falling behind in the language space for years and years and years. And all of a sudden they come out with this language that has very strong functional
influences.
Yeah, influences. Exactly. And given their kind of conservative nature towards this stuff, I can't help but see it as being a big red flag for, like, just this momentum behind functional languages. And a lot of people at Apple are Haskell nerds and stuff like that, which is wild.
I mean, functional stuff has been creeping into languages for a long time.
Sure.
I mean Ruby claims it, Python too.
Yep. Yep.
Things like that.
Anyway. People, you know, especially a lot of longtime OS X, like Cocoa developers, complain about this new stuff and about having to learn new stuff. Mm. And it seems crazy to me. I can understand having trouble learning it, right? I can understand it being hard to learn. I really can, because I think that it's probably harder than it needs to be making a switch from imperative object-oriented programming to functional programming, like at a pure stance on both sides, you know what I mean? Moving from like a pure object-oriented thing to a pure functional thing.
Well, you're starting over.
You're starting over. Yeah. And it's kind of insane. It's hard to wrap your mind around it first. So I understand it being difficult. I don't understand resisting that difficulty just because it's difficult. Like, I really don't. And that's where I was getting with the momentum stuff. Like, I think there's momentum towards functional programming. So what you are doing as a programmer, especially on Apple's platform right now, I think if you're not taking notice of the functional stuff right. and of the stuff that Swift can do, even if you're not using it all right now, but this seems like a great time to try to get up ahead of the curve.
Yeah,
and start wrapping your mind around some cool new stuff that you can do, because if you don't, then what happens 2-3 years from now when you turn around and you're like, oh, it's too late?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if 2-3 years is too short of a time frame, but that drives me crazy, the
yeah.
readability argument, because it's like...
Yeah, I get it. I mean, it's totally understandable that you would say it's not readable when you don't know it.
It's just it's so subjective, though.
Yeah,
and people
exactly.
treat it like it's an objective thing, right?
Right?
People treat readability, quote unquote, as if it's like
yeah.
it is readable or it is not readable. It's
right.
like, no. I mean, it's a lot of that has to do with familiarity. And yeah, there are things that once you're inside a language, you can do to make stuff readable inside that language. You know what I mean? But those rules are different for every mm-hmm. language. They're different for Haskell than they are for Swift. They're different for Objective-C than they are for Ruby. They're different, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's different rules that grow up around the language based on the way people are using the language.
Right.
So, I don't know. So what else? Final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I don't know, man. Do you think people are going to have the Scala problem in Swift?
What's the Scala problem?
Where they program in Scala and they see these things that are really cool. And they want to know where they came from. And then they find out it's Haskell and they change languages.
I don't know. Maybe.
I think we have Tony. I think we almost
yeah,
have Tony.
Yeah. I think people do that now, though. You know what I mean? I think people, like... I think there is definitely a sense from some people that I follow that are frustrated with Swift because there are these holes
yeah.
that Swift has right now that are basically solved problems. You know what I mean? And I know that's easy to say that they're solved problems without knowing implementation details
right.
inside Swift, or even without knowing the constraints that Swift is under at the implementation level. You know what I mean? Like, I have no
yeah.
idea what it's like writing stuff to run on the Objective-C runtime.
And I mean, that's always going to happen when you start a new language.
Right.
Like, you're not going to have a 100% complete language
right.
like in year one.
Right. But I do think that people are already excited for Swift and excited for the possibility, but a little frustrated that some of the things are wonky and some
mm-hmm.
of the things are weird. And I think that that's the same problem that we kind of been talking about before, which is like, maybe they just want Haskell.
Yeah.
And if you just want Haskell, then you're probably not going to be happy with...
No matter how close it gets.
No.
Yeah.
Because it's not, at the end of the day, Swift is not Haskell.
Right.
Swift is not Rust. Swift is not any of these other things.
Right. And it shouldn't be.
No, it shouldn't be. No. Swift is Swift. It's its own thing.
Right.
It'd be like complaining about Haskell because the type system isn't quite as flexible as...
Because it doesn't have dependent types or something.
Yeah. Right. Or duck typing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to watch. I do hope that people get more interested in Haskell, because more than anything, I think it's a fascinating environment to work in.
Yeah.
It's working, like, you start working in Haskell and you start, you write stuff so differently
yeah.
than anywhere else. And I enjoy writing that kind of stuff because
yeah.
it's like, it's nice to step away from this environment that I'm super comfortable in and move into an environment where, like, in the past few weeks, like, I've been doing all this Haskell stuff and I've rage quit a number of times just because I have no idea what I'm doing and I just feel like a bumbling idiot. And then like I don't even know how to look up document. Like, I don't know how to solve my own problems. I don't
yeah.
know how to look up the documentation for the things that I want to try to do. And I just kind of stare at these
yeah.
web pages and I like thumb stuff into Hoogle and I'm just like, I have no idea like how I'm supposed to use this thing, but this is kind of a thing I need. And then the results I get back are like, okay, I did something wrong because these results don't
yeah.
make any sense, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, this idea that you kind of, when you switch to something completely different, you have to start over
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have those frustrations,
mm-hmm.
but you also kind of get to start over. So you get to
yeah,
have those,
it's
like,
freeing.
Yeah, those like beginner moments where like something works that you didn't expect it to. And like,
yeah,
that's really cool.
And you get that excitement of like,
yeah.
you get Haskell to compile and it's like, oh, you know, like, holy shit. Like, you save real quick because, you know, it's like,
don't lose it.
Get commit right now because I need to get back to this if 5 minutes from now when I break the whole thing. And
yeah.
It's fun. And I think a lot of people have forgotten because it is highs and lows. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like me literally rage quitting one day and then calming down and coming back the next day and being like,
yeah,
okay, let me look at this again. And it's like, oh, I'm an idiot. Like, yeah, that's not how either works. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like, all right. I got it. And then, like, then I can like go in. And once I started down that road, it got easier and I had more of those small victories and, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah. And it gets better. I mean, yeah.
Like it always does, yeah. right? Yeah. For everything.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm sure I rage quit Objective-C when I was learning it
yeah.
a number of times. Yeah. So we can wrap it up.
Sure.
Show notes are going to be found at buildphase.fm/61. Questions and comments, you can let us know on Twitter at buildphase or via email, buildphase@thoughtbot.com. And as always, we appreciate ratings and reviews on iTunes. All right. Thanks for coming on, Pat.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Talk to you later.
Bye.